Good morning. KPCW News Time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Let's find out what's in store for our weather this weekend. Something tells me that Cedric Haynes is going to have a forecast that we're all going to like. What do we got?
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. Winter storm warnings continue for the area, both for Park City and the Heber Valley. In the Heber Valley, we're looking at about 1 to 3 inches of snow expected here over the next 24 hours, maybe some isolated higher totals. Meanwhile, for Park City, we're looking at the potential of picking up anywhere from 8 to 16 inches of snow as we go throughout the upcoming weekend. We'll see off and on periods of snow coming through the area today. We'll get a lull as we get towards your midday on Friday before the heavier precipitation arrives Friday evening into Friday night. So plan accordingly. Friday night into Saturday morning is going to be quite wintry for us across the Wasatch Back, and we could have some travel difficulties. That's why we have the winter storm warnings that are in effect. Otherwise, as we go throughout the rest of the weekend, again, as I mentioned, we'll see some periods of off and on rain and snow in the valleys and around the Heber Valley. And then as you get into Park City, we'll see some periods of snow from time to time. Otherwise, we'll see those chilly temperatures sticking around across the area. Now, as we head into next week, we'll start to dry things out, but we'll still stay somewhat unsettled. So look for more clouds than sunshine, and temperatures pretty much hovering into the 40s in the Heber Valley, upper 40s by the time we get towards the end of next week. Meanwhile, Park City, we'll see those temperatures going from the 30s this weekend to high temperatures into the low to mid 40s by the middle of next week. We'll see again a mixture of clouds and some sunshine, but overall drier conditions are expected across most of the Wasatch Back, except for a couple of passing weak storm systems moving through. But no doubt about it, as we go throughout this weekend, again, we've got those winter storm conditions that will be around, and that means that you could have some very difficult travel here, especially over our mountain passes. Again, we're looking at about 8 to 16 inches of snow expected for the Park City area, with about 1 to 4 inches at least expected for the Heber Valley. And of course, we'll continue to monitor those passes as you head up towards the mountains. We know it's a busy weekend with a lot of ski resorts opening, so take it easy. Remember, in ice and snow, just take it slow. As I look at your forecast for the Wasatch Back, I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
I kind of wonder if we could persuade Cedric to give us that forecast more often in the next few weeks. It would be really helpful. Let's find out what all this snow means for the backcountry. We have the Utah Avalanche Center on the phone. I'm not sure who's joining me this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Brooke Mauschen from the Utah Avalanche Center. How's it going?
Good. Well, you're about to tell us. What's it going to be like this weekend?
Yeah, well, starting out with like today, we had a northwesterly, kind of wet, warm, and windy storm blow in overnight. And during the day today, we're going to see some precipitation with lots of wind. Temperatures will be quite high, so it'll be pretty sloppy. And in the places where there was snow prior to this storm, there's weak snow there. So that dense, heavy snow is going to fall on top of weak snow, which is going to, you know, elevate our avalanche danger throughout the day today. We're expecting to see considerable avalanche danger by the afternoon today on high shady terrain, and more moderate danger on the north half of the compass at mid elevations as well. Heading into the weekend, it seems like the bulk of the precipitation from the storm, at least in our mountains over towards Park City, will fall tonight, and there'll be a potential for hazard to rise even higher tomorrow morning.
Okay. Brooke, thanks. It sounds like it's going to be a little bit sketchy out here, particularly with this thin cover and this wet stuff underneath.
Yeah, totally. Like I said, where there was that weak snow, we're going to have a slab on top of it that will be likely to be released. And then, you know, this wet, kind of like wet snow will paste on to the more shady or the more solar aspects where there wasn't a ton of snow before the storm. And it'll be just enough to not be able to see those rocks and logs, but it won't keep you off of them. So just keep your eyes out there if you choose to head out.
All right, Brooke, thanks, and have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too.
Coming up, we're going to hear from Connor Thomas, who is at Park City Mountain Resort as the resort is opening for the season. Then Bianca Velasquez from Rocky Mountain Power is going to join us to update us on yet another new scam. We'll hear from Keith Lilly about the upcoming 9th Christmas concert in the mountains. And we're going to finish our hour by hearing from Grace Dorfler, who got to go to Deer Valley this morning for opening day while I'm here stuck in the studio. Stay tuned. We have a pretty good show this morning. Well, Connor Thomas is over at Park City Mountain Resort for opening day. What's the scene like there, Connor?
Hey, Roger. I'm at the bottom of the Sunrise Gondola. That's new for this year. About at least 30 people were here when I showed up at 7:45. And The line only keeps growing with people excited to take their first ride here. And I'm here with the top spokesman for the resort, John Canely. John, maybe you could explain a little bit about what it took to get this lift open this year and what else you're opening here on opening day.
Hi, John.
Hi, Roger. Hi, Connor. Thank you guys for having me. We are, like Connor said, standing here at the bottom of the Sunrise Gondola. And it is so great to see it spinning and ready to welcome guests aboard for their first ski and snowboard laps off of it today. This has been a project that's been 2 years in the making, and it is ready to go. So that makes everybody here at the resort on opening day very excited, very happy. Like Connor said, guests are already queuing up. Music is going. There's some light flakes falling from the sky right now, and overall the energy is really good. So we're really looking forward to welcoming guests aboard.
It just
go ahead, Roger.
I was gonna say, it just seems totally perfect that you guys have arranged for us to have a little snow here on opening day.
Oh man, if only we could just order it up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so for those who aren't familiar with it, Sunrise Gondola is new. Can you just try to describe, give our listeners a perspective on where does it start and where does it go?
Yeah, so the bottom terminal is right near the Park City or Pendry Park City Hotel, and it goes up to the Red Pine Lodge, where guests can then get off and have access to the High Meadow Lift, the Saddleback Lift. They can go down to Tombstone. There's several options for lifts that they can access once they get off the top.
And again, if I were to park down at the lot down at 224 and took mm-hmm. that gondola up, how would I get to the Sunrise Gondola?
You're talking the cabriolet?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So when you get off the cabriolet, you'll go to your left. We have signage guiding guests straight to the bottom terminal. You'll go through the Pendry Plaza, and once you're in the Pendry Plaza, you really can't miss it. It's a nice big terminal, big cabins. It's right there.
And obviously, you know, lift technology continues to improve. Can you share a little bit about this gondola and how fast it goes, how many people it can carry, those kinds of statistics?
Yeah, so what it does, it is a 10-person gondola, and it is a brand new way to get out of this base area. So what it does is it nearly doubles our uphill capacity out of the Canyons Village base area. And really what that means is we're going to be able to get lines out of the base area that much faster so that skiers and riders can spend more time on the slopes.
Okay. John, what's going on over at the other base this morning, if anything? Are there lifts open there as well?
Yeah, over there, the plan is to have the Payday Lift, first-time lift, and the Tommyknocker conveyor. We'll have, you know, the traditional banner break up at the top of the Payday Lift. So all of the fun, exciting activities that you would expect on opening day. There's some donuts welcoming guests, some hot chocolate. And also, I believe there is live music over there now. Everything just designed to bring the excitement for this day that we've been waiting for all summer.
When were the first people there in the middle of the night to get in line to be first, you know?
Oh, I was going to go ask them right after this interview.
Okay.
So I'll have that information for you
later in the broadcast.
Later, I'll be calling in about 9:30 again today.
And did they hand out the T-shirts as they have so often in the past that says, I was first, you know?
I have heard T-shirts, but it's, you know, it's that two-step first chair here at Canyons.
Yeah.
You're
going
to get those first guys in line to ride up, and then the banner breaks at the top of Saddleback on this side of the mountain. I imagine it'll be Payday on the other side. So we've got the Red Pine Gondola spinning this morning as well. Just a lot of good energy right now. I'm sure you could hear the DJ.
Oh, yeah.
It was really loud with snow guns when I pulled up. The whole mountain kind of roaring, so...
Now, are you geared up? Do you get to go up and try to cover that banner break?
Yeah, I mean, my ski edges are really rusty, Roger, and I forgot where my yak tracks are, so I'm really wearing through the soles of my boots, which is not good for this season, but I'm sure I'll get it together by tomorrow.
Can you pass me back to John?
All right. John, just real quick, one more question from Roger.
John, before we go...
Yeah, Roger.
Obviously highly dependent on weather. What is your thought as to when you might be able to open a little bit more of the mountain this winter?
Yeah, so the good news is we've had some pretty good snowmaking temperatures at some of those higher elevations, so that has given us the opportunity to start making snow on our secondary package. So we are making progress towards that as we speak. And we are certainly going to keep everyone updated as to when more terrain opens on our social media channel. We'll stay in touch with everyone that way, and looking forward to trying to get Bonanza Lift open soon, potentially down to Tombstone open soon. Those are all places where we've been focused on making snow and trying to get that open as quick as possible.
Okay, John, Connor, thanks for letting us at least feel as though we were there on opening day. Well, on a day like this, it's kind of interesting to think about opening days in the past. Connor got a chance to talk to Dalton Gackle. He's the research coordinator at Park City Museum about local opening days over the years and ski history in general.
And again, this is KPCW reporter Connor Thomas here in the studio with Dalton Gackle. He runs the research library at the Park City Museum there on Main Street. Dalton, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the reasons we wanted to have you on this morning is because it's opening days for all the Wasatch Back resorts and resorts around Utah. And of course, the biggest thing this year has been the delay from some of the delayed snowfall. I was wondering if you could kind of put it in some historical perspective about where this year's somewhat delayed opening day stacks up from opening days past.
Yeah, so this year actually isn't all that abnormal. So over the years, the dates have changed. Early on, they were actually later than this, just because there wasn't a lot of snowmaking ability early on throughout the years until the mid-70s. We start to get some primitive snowmaking, and then from then on, it just improves year over year to what we have today, where they can start making snow as soon as it's cold enough to have the snow stick, right? And that's actually more been the main problem with this year. Is why this year feels so weird is because the air and the ground haven't been cold enough for the snow making even to stick. So not only have we just not gotten natural snow, but like the snow making hasn't been able to start until much later. Normally, you know, like it's not that abnormal to have an off snow year where it, you know, the snow is delayed a little bit, but usually it's cold enough by early November for the resorts to start making snow. And so that's why this year has felt like super delayed, because they haven't even been able to start making snow until like last week, right? So it's just been a little strange in that sense. But there have definitely been years where the resorts have opened a lot later. Like I said, historically, they were all always kind of opening like mid-December, if they could. Eventually, especially as the snow banking became more prominent, they were mostly able to open around Thanksgiving was their goal, or with Deer Valley, usually the first week of December was just their goal, because Deer Valley, I think, just in my opinion, likes to have more runs open on opening day than, like, say, PCMR could, you know, just open three runs off of one lift and call it opening day, whereas I think Deer Valley historically has tended to wait until they have more of their lifts and runs open for opening day. So theirs is usually a little bit behind Park City Mountains.
The latest opening day that I'm aware of, kind of in my own rudimentary historical knowledge, is the very first one in late December at Treasure Mountain, which is now PCMR Mountain Village. That's just because that's when they opened the resort, and that was its grand opening. But do you have offhand, like, what the latest ever recorded opening day for either resort is?
Yeah, so Treasure Mountains opened December 21st of 1963. That was just, like, their target date. That's when they could open. And for a while, that was the, like, latest that they had opened, because the years after that, they were opening days or weeks earlier than that, until 1976-77. It was a really terrible snow year that year. That's, again, when I mentioned there's really primitive snowmaking, so they don't have as much of an ability to make snow then, and there was just no natural snow for October, November, December, and so they actually didn't open the resort until January, which is pretty crazy. I think it was like January 5th or 6th or something like that.
That seldom happens. I mean, on the other side of the coin, you know, 2022, 23 was a great snow year. Is there anything, you know, back in your records about what our best, quote unquote, earliest opening day was?
Yeah, I tried doing some searching for this, and the resorts probably actually have the records somewhere, so they might be the best places to ask. But the earliest I could find, based on like newspaper records and stuff, was October 26th for the 1996-97 year. So that's pretty early. But the newspaper record noted that it was the second earliest opening on record, but then didn't mention what the earliest was. And there was like four articles, separate articles, that mentioned this second earliest opening, but then not mentioning the original like earliest date. So
the early 80s was really snowy. I know. Maybe that.
Yeah, it could have been literally any year. But yeah, it was frustrating when I was researching, trying to figure that out, just trying to track that down. So maybe the resorts actually have that data somewhere and can tell us. But and then as far as Deer Valley goes, their latest opening that I could find was actually their opening date as well. So similar to Treasure Mountains, when it opened, Deer Valley just like wanted to make sure everything was right and perfect to open. So December 26th, 1981 is when they opened. And that, as far as I know, that's the latest they've ever opened. And the earliest they've opened that I can find is Thanksgiving in 1984, I think, November 28th of one of the years in the middle of 1980s. And Park West that same year opened on November 28th. At that time, Park West was a separate resort. Now, obviously, it's part of Park City Mountain as the canyon side. But
you mentioned Park West. I'm kind of curious because the canyon side of opening day is a little different because you got to take the gondola up and then come back down on the gondola, download once your ski day is done, because they won't have everything going straight to the base open for a little bit. Has that always been the case for, I guess, the history of Park West, and then it was Wolf?
Yeah, Park West has always been usually the last to open, or sometimes just concurrently with Deer Valley, just because they had, A, more terrain over there to cover, and then B, less snowfall there typically than the two resorts closer to town. And so it was Park West when it opened, and then it eventually became Wolf Mountain in the 90s. They were Western-themed names when it was Park West, and then when Wolf Mountain came in, they changed it to be a lot of animal names. And then in 1997, the resort switched again, and it became The Canyons, and then eventually Vail came in 2005, bought the resort, and changed it to Canyons Village, and then when they then bought Park City Mountain in 2014, they merged the resorts to make it one like meg resort, quote unquote. Now it's, you know, Canyons Village at Park City Mountain.
Yeah, and I'm curious if you've done any research about closing days. It's way too early to talk about this, and I know people don't want to hear about closing day on opening day, but any variation, and does that track maybe with opening days at all, or is it kind of random?
Yeah, it doesn't have anything to do with opening days necessarily. Like, obviously, they'd like to extend the season as long as possible no matter what year, just because they make more money when they're open more days, right? Usually, historically, it's been around mid-April when the resorts close. Every now and then we get an amazing snow year, and we extend that into May. Some years the snow's not great, or it gets warmer a little bit earlier, and so like end of March has kind of happened a couple of times. It was interesting. One year I saw that the resort was still open, Park City Mountain was still open until mid-April, but it was warm enough where like some of the runs had closed, and then warm enough that the golf course actually opened mid-March. So I want to say it was like March 26th or something was opening day for the golf course, and the resort was still open, so theoretically somebody could have gone, skied a few runs, and then gone and played a round of golf all on the same day up in Park City, which is pretty unique and doesn't happen that often.
Yeah, so, you know, I mentioned at the top of the broadcast you're the research coordinator at Park City Museum. First of all, what is the research library that you maintain? Could you kind of describe, you know, what that position entails?
Sure. So I manage the Hal Compton Research Library. It is a repository of information about Park City's history. So the research library itself contains my office and a couple of my colleagues, and then all sorts of books, texts, reports, articles, other information in the like library portion itself that people can freely come in and go through and do research. And then we have research computer stations to use our internal database that hosts a lot of our images and collections and that kind of thing. And then we also have attached to the room some of our collection storage. And so if researchers make appointments, they can come in and go through archival materials, objects, that kind of thing for any types of research projects they're working on.
What kind of ski-related, ski area-related exhibits do you have for the general public that might come in for Main Street?
Yeah, so the museum obviously covers all of our history, but we do have several chunks devoted to our skiing history or the transition from mining to skiing. So one of the main pieces is that big transition piece. When the resort first opened, mining was still happening in town. And while it wasn't happening on Treasure Mountains, they reused a lot of mining equipment in their operations. And a lot of the miners became workers of the resort originally to keep some type of work going. And so the skier subway is one of those cool early things that we get out of Treasure Mountains Resort. Opens in 1965, so a couple of years after the resort gets going. But they needed another way for skiers to get to the top of the mountain without, you know, putting another above ground lift, because the gondola at the time that was there, you know, had to be put on wind hold a lot, and so they didn't want something that would have to be stopped in the middle of the day. And so they ingeniously decided, you know what, we're going to reuse an old drain tunnel that leads to a mine shaft. We're going to have people ride the train car down the drain tunnel, then get off of the train car, get in the mine shaft elevator, ride that up to the surface and pop out what is now close to the Thanes lift. It's located at the Thanes mine up in Park City Mountain in Thanes Canyon. And they had this going for a few years. It actually closes in 1969, ultimately because it wasn't very popular.
Which is bizarre to me, because like wind hold is still a major thing at the bases.
Yeah, the novelty of it like sounds cool to us, right? Like, oh, that's so neat, like riding a mine train car and then like riding the elevator up to the surface, that'd be so cool. But the problem was our mines historically are notoriously wet underground all year round. Underground maintains the same temperature, even though the surface temperature fluctuates. So it's going to be like 50 degrees underground. And so the water is going to be dripping constantly all the time. And so the train car is going through this drain tunnel, right? And there's tons of water. And so people are getting wet as they're going along. Then you hop in the elevator and then you pop out at the surface. And at the surface, it's another couple thousand feet higher than it is at Main Street, right? And so you pop out and you freeze like a popsicle because it's cold and windy up there. And so it just like ultimately people typically would ride it like one time in their experience and be like, you know, that was enough. And, you know, I'll just wait in line next time at the chairlift or hope the gondola's not on wind hold. And so ultimately, like, it just declined in popularity over the course of like 5 years.
All right. Well, I guess that is where a lot of the snowmaking water lives now, is in those underground mine shafts anyway. So it still does allow us to get out there on the mountain in some sense.
Yeah, and the Spiro Tunnel is still there. It's over, the entrance to it is at the Silver Star area of town, right by the Silver Star lift there. And you can go check it out, like peer inside. There's some historical signs that we worked on with the city. And you can read more about the history of the skier subway and that kind of unique thing. As far as we know, it's the only underground ski lift to ever have existed anywhere in the world, which is really neat and a cool thing we can showcase. Like you said, like the novelty of it alone, like, would be cool if it was still going, right? But it's just like not cost effective at this point for them to like want to do that again ever. So
yeah. All right, well, I think we're about out of time, but do you have any closing thoughts on opening day?
I hope people just enjoy their opening days for whatever resort you choose to go to. I hope it ends up being a fantastic snow year this year. You know, we're trending historically, you know, warmer and warmer every year, so later and later openings. We're changing El Nino and La Nina weather cycles, affecting our snow loads and everything. So I really hope Park City can continue our amazing recreational resort success, but we'll just have to see, right? Time will tell, and you know, maybe the historian 100 years from now will be looking back at Park City's skiing days as a thing of the past, like we're looking at the mining days as a thing of the past. It'll be really interesting to see.
All right. Dalton Gackle, he runs the research library at Park City Museum. Thank you again.
The holidays are not only a time for presents and family, it's also a time when the scammers come out. Here to warn us about some current scams relating to electricity is Bianca Velazquez of Rocky Mountain Power. Morning, Bianca. Can you hear me?
Yes. How are you?
We're great. Thanks for coming on this morning, Bianca. So, Bianca, do you typically see an uptick in scam activity during this time of year?
Absolutely. Scammers typically try to strike during the holidays, and they contact customers posing as Rocky Mountain Power employees, actually.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the types of scams that we see. One type, as I understand it, involves you get a call and it goes, this is Rocky Mountain Power, and we're about to cut off your service. Does that ever really happen, or are those always just scams?
No, we would never call to threaten to turn off the service. And one thing you can do to ensure if it is a Rocky Mountain Power employee or not is that we will always have your account number. So you can always ask whoever's calling if they have your account number. And if they don't, it's because they're a scammer. So just make sure that's a great way to check and confirm whether or not it is a real call or not.
And are they getting sophisticated enough? Are they able to spoof Rocky Mountain phone numbers so that, like, your phone might actually say Rocky Mountain Power even if it's not?
Yes, technology these days, they definitely are getting a little bit trickier to identify. So always make sure to ask them for your account number, cross-reference that with the number that's on your bill.
And one of the things that, you know, we get a lot of these texts these days. You'll just get a random text that has a meaningless message and, you know, like, will I see you today? And you sort of wonder, how are those people going to make money? Here we have scams where I think there are sort of real ways they try to extract money from unsuspecting people. Tell us how they do that.
They are definitely trying to threaten with saying that your bill is overdue or that you need to send them money through a prepaid debit card. And so we would never ask for a prepaid debit card to pay for your bill. So that's definitely one of the ways that you can, that's a red flag. So make sure that you understand that's not something we would ever do. And if that does happen, please contact our customer service number. That way we can make sure that we are, taking track of those threats there, and you can, that way you can protect yourself.
And now one threat is, as I understand it, the one associated with, I'm going to cut your power. But another one is where they say you damaged our equipment or something like that. Tell us about that kind of a scam.
Yeah, oftentimes, you know, especially with like the weather going on and things like that and outages, potentially happening due to the winter weather, they do try to threaten customers with that, saying that, you know, you damaged this property or something like that. This is broken. We need this amount of money in order to fix it. So that is another thing we would never do. That's something that, especially if they're threatening to turn off your power, we would never do that in a threatened time frame that way.
Mm-hmm. So what's the best strategy? If I get a call like, and it's somebody saying something like, you need to pay your bill immediately, or you've damaged our equipment, what's the best strategy for me to follow?
Absolutely. I would say that the first thing to do always is ask for your account number. If mm-hmm. they don't have it, they are not Rocky Mountain Power.
And what about hanging up and calling customer service?
Oh, you can absolutely do that. Okay. Our customer service center is there 24 hours, 7 days a week, in order to support our customers in these questionable calls. And the number for that is 888-221-7070. So always call that number immediately. You can hang up, call that, confirm with them what's going on with your bill, with your specific situation, and they'll be able to validate whether or not that's happening. But very, very likely, if they don't have your number or your account number, and if they're making these specific types of threats, it is not Rocky Mountain Power.
And I take it it's important that even if you're smart enough to realize this was a scammer, that you also at Rocky Mountain Power, so you also want to hear about it so that you can try to track what's going on. So I take you would encourage customers or people if they get one of these weird calls to report it to you guys so you can try to do something about it.
Yes, absolutely. We definitely want to keep track of it and be able to navigate the situation accordingly.
Okay. Anything else we should touch on scams this holiday season?
Nope. It's pretty straightforward. Just take care of yourselves and just make sure that you watch for these red flags, especially the prepaid debit card one as well. That we would never ask for that. So please protect yourself this holiday season and spread the information to loved ones so that they know how to protect themselves as well.
Okay. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Well, a Victims' Rights Committee found no wrongdoing in how the Wasatch County Sheriff's and Attorney's Office have treated the family of a slain hideout resident. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has an update in the fatal road rage shooting case.
The committee unanimously decided Monday the rights of Patrick Hayes' family have not been violated during the investigation of his death and the prosecution of the shooter. Hayes was fatally shot outside Jordanelle State Park in September 2024. Summit County resident Greg Kyle DeBoer was charged with felony obstruction of justice after he told investigators he shot Hayes, then buried the gun. He was not charged with the shooting itself. In a complaint filed last month with the 4th District Victims' Rights Committee, an attorney for Hayes' family said county leaders have treated them with silence, resistance, or indifference. The complaint alleged Wasatch County leaders violated their rights to be informed about the legal process and to be treated with dignity and respect. During the Monday meeting, Hayes' fiance, Sue Ann Kern, said she and her family felt like they'd been left to navigate a confusing court system without guidance or regular updates from county investigators and prosecutors. Sheriff Jared Rigby and Prosecutor McKay King both told the committee they had communicated openly with the Hayes family. King said he didn't want to keep talking with the family about his decision not to charge DeBoer with homicide.
There were times when there were efforts by members of the family to rehash things that had already been discussed. And I just contacted, through the victim's advocate and said that I didn't feel that having that discussion again would be beneficial to either side.
Committee member Kevin Thurman, who's a city attorney, said he had some concerns about how the attorney's office had handled the case, especially the decision to extend a plea deal to DeBoer. He said he had looked through all the communications with the victim advocate.
In each case, it seemed like it was kind of maybe not an afterthought, but just like, I've already made the decision and we're going to now meet with the victim to discuss my decision rather than being involved in the process.
Utah County Sheriff Mike Smith, who's on the committee, said he agrees Wasatch County may not have followed best practices, but he didn't believe there was an actual rights violation. After about an hour and a half of discussion, the Victims' Rights Committee said although the family's experience was not ideal, the county had not violated their rights. Committee members encouraged the county to treat victims, quote, as if their input matters. In a statement, Rigby said he welcomed the decision. He said his office grieves for the Hayes family but enforces the law fairly. Meanwhile, in 4th District Court, DeBoer has pleaded not guilty to a single obstruction of justice charge. A pretrial hearing is scheduled for January. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
And we'll be hearing a little bit more from Grace over at Deer Valley in a few minutes. Meanwhile, Summit County leaders delayed a decision on raising taxes for the Snyderville Basin Recreation District Wednesday. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the council was deadlocked.
With one council member absent from the December 3rd Summit County Council meeting, the four others couldn't come to a consensus on Basin Recreation's 2026 budget. That's because the district's asking for a 15% property tax increase this year. Rather than leave Basin Rec without a budget in a failed 2-2 vote, the council rescheduled for December 10th. Council member Chris Robinson could have joined the meeting remotely to break the tie, but Chair Tanya Hansen thought he should be able to hear the lengthy public comment first.
That's why I think we need to continue the meeting so he can watch the video. Thank you for that clarification. Hear the public comment before he votes on it.
Most residents who spoke at the public hearing opposed the tax increase, saying they're weary of paying more each year to various government entities and districts, such as Silver Springs resident Bill Rusconi.
You guys are just bad timing because it's happened to everybody here where our taxes are just going through the roof. My taxes have doubled twice in the last 5 years.
Basin Rec says the 15% increase would raise an extra $1.3 million for new employees' salaries and ongoing costs, such as facilities maintenance and insurance. It works out to $6.10 extra annually per $100,000 of a home's taxable value. That's more than the district's October informational materials, which said it would work out to $3.35. Regardless, Basin Rec business manager Brad Rogers says the money will be used to provide services residents expect.
Basin Rec actually is much more than just the field house. We've got thousands of acres of open space, almost 200 miles of trails that we also maintain, even programs such as safe routes to schools that provide plowed routes to school children.
But residents and some council members balked at the proposed new hires, such as a marketing employee, with commenter Nicholas Schapper calling the budget expansion-oriented. Council members Hansen and Canis Hart indicated they were against the tax increase, while Roger Armstrong and Megan McKenna thought it made sense. They'll take up the item again at the December 10th meeting in Colville and on Zoom at 6 p.m. There won't be public comment, but Hansen recommended residents email the council with feedback before then. Board Chair Ben Castro also noted that Basin Rec's proposed 15% increase is not a 15% increase to residents' overall tax bills. It's only for the portion Basin Rec collects. The state lists 43 different taxing entities in Summit County, whether they're cities, towns, utilities, school districts, rec districts, or the county government itself. Their borders are all different, too. Basin Rec's boundaries are roughly the same as the Park City School District's plus Promontory, but don't include most of Park City proper. Summit County and Basin Rec are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, I do have an update from PCMR. It appears that, in fact, the first group who wanted to ride the chair arrived yesterday morning at 7 a.m. The resort said, no, you really can't be here yet, so they couldn't come back until 1 o'clock this morning, which, in fact, they did. They camped out and woke up at 5 a.m. to get ready for the first chair. Back to news. Park City's Centennial House is undergoing renovations that will give the historic Upper Main Street building new life. KPCW's Christine Weller reports there will likely be some traffic impacts throughout construction.
Centennial House, formerly known as the Durkin Boarding House, was an important housing source during Park City's mining era and early skiing days. But the historic building at 176 Main Street has stood vacant for more than two decades. In that time, the building had become uninhabitable and was condemned in 2007 for safety reasons. In June, Park City's Historic Preservation Board approved a plan to bring the 124-year-old building back to life. Local builder Pete Olson and his company PJ Builders are doing the work.
The plan was to remove the historic siding and historic elements off the outside, and then to demo the whole building, and then we will replicate it. So we're going to build it back in exactly the same spot, the same dimensions.
Olson said the demolition was necessary as much of the interior was unsalvageable due to mold, water damage, and other issues. The teardown will be completed next week. But the work won't stop there. Once the old building is removed, the project will proceed much like new construction with all new plumbing and electrical systems. Throughout construction, there will also likely be traffic impacts on Upper Main Street.
We're trying to mitigate that as much as possible. But yeah, being that Main Street is barely a lane wide in front of the Centennial Building, that's going to be one of our big challenges.
The project is expected to be completed in around 18 months. Once finished, the house will have 6 bedrooms, 7 bathrooms, and a 1-car garage on the side of the building. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, the holiday season is in full swing, and tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at the Shepherd of the Mountains Church, there's going to be a Christmas concert. Here to tell us about it is Keith Lilly. Morning, Keith. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Roger. Thank you for allowing me to come in. This has been going on since 2017. I enjoy Christmas music and had the opportunity to gather some musicians together to perform. I call it Christmas in the Mountains. And other than the fact during the pandemic period, we didn't have a concert naturally, but we have a fantastic organist coming in. He's traveled throughout the United States, traveled throughout Europe, and he's played at the Tabernacle down in Salt Lake City Square. So he will be coming in to play some music.
And that's Dr. James Welch, is that his name?
That is correct.
And so when he is doing his segment, will he be alone just playing Christmas music?
That would be correct.
Mm-hmm. And, okay, so he does one segment. What kind of music will he play?
He's probably more in the realm of I guess I could almost call it a classical popular
okay.
type range. There will probably be a couple of classical pieces, and then there will be a lot of popular music. There are a lot of arrangements available out there on the organ, and especially Christmas tunes. In fact, a number of the arrangements have been arranged by Mormons down in Salt Lake City. And so you hear some of these tunes and you think, oh, wow, that's really great. So it makes it even more special.
And I take it, does the concert always feature like a range of different musicians? Or like, are there like different segments?
Absolutely. I'm glad you asked me about that. The second year involved, I became familiar with a gifted music school in Salt Lake City. It's directed and started really by Eugene Watanabe and his wife. And they provide scholarships. They actually have an attendance right now of over 500 students. And for their conservatory, the elite students, they provide free scholarships, free musical scholarships. And then there is tuition provided for students below the elite conservatory level. I have visited the school. There are pianos in most of the rooms. There's an audition room. It's just unbelievable. And I became acquainted with a young student who has traveled throughout the United States and is currently in school up in San Francisco, Ezekiel Sokoloff. Mm-hmm. And you sit back and you think, wow. And this young man started out. So there are violins, violas, cellists, pianists, and the whole nine yards. And the school is also open to the community for them to come in and practice for education.
And so you'll have a group of those. How big an ensemble will be playing at the concert tomorrow?
Well, what occurred this year was that my recitalist, Dr. Welch, had only a few dates available. He listed those dates, and the one that we could nail down was December 6th. So what I found out when I was talking to the director at the Gifted Music School and his assistant director was I was going to be limited because those students are in school right now. Mm. In fact, the two students I have coming up are being rushed up after a 4 p.m. class down at the Gifted Music School. And this is a Saturday.
I was going to say, they have to go to school on Saturday?
Well, some of them do, very, very definitely. So the two students I have, one is Luke Hong. At the age of 10, he performed at Carnegie Hall.
Wow.
Now he's only 13 now, so perhaps he's a little bit better than that. And then the other one is Margaret Jones, and she just was admitted to the elite conservatory school, and she will be playing as well. She plays jazz for her high school band, etc.
And so the two of them will be together?
They will be actually playing separately.
Okay.
I asked Luke to perform a number. It's a very simple number. There is a tune called Carol of the Bells.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I have it's called a Hauptwerk digital pipe organ, virtual pipe organ. And on this Hauptwerk organ are 10 different pipe organs from throughout the world, but including a harpsichord and a carillon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, what better way to experience Carol of the Bells if Luke could perform that on the carillon on the Hauptwerk? So he agreed to do that. So we will be playing one other tune on the piano, but he's graced me with the chance of listening to him on the carillon.
And I understand you're also going to have some Swiss handbells?
The Swiss handbell choirs, and they will be coming in from Salt Lake City. They are actually out of Midway, Utah. And we've had them for the last, since 2017, they began with us. Carrie Knapp is a director, a fantastic director of the handbell choir. So they are from all areas and they practice. They will probably be giving about 4 or 5 concerts this year. And I believe I am the first concert they will be giving.
How many handbells? I'm visualizing a line of young people with you know, like 10 or 15. How many do they have?
I'd have to take a count on that, but I would say there are at least 20 handbell players with their table set up and their bells hanging there. And it's just beautiful to hear.
Okay. Who have you left out? Taylor Doobie?
Taylor Doobie, unfortunately, we've had a strike on that. She had a conflict in schedule. I just found out about that last night. I am scuffling around right now I want to contact the director of trumpets at the University of Utah and see whether Payton Sheldon might have somebody who's available to just kick in immediately. So I'm still searching for that, or we will have an additional number by the bell choir and perhaps the organist as well.
And again, the range of music, you've mentioned some, will we see things ranging from sort of purely traditional to jazz over the course of the evening?
We may have had that with Taylor Doobie, unfortunately, since she won't be attending because she is in the jazz end of it. Mm-hmm. The tune by Margaret Jones, since she does play with the school, I'm not sure about Mel Torme's, you know, Christmas tune, but there's a faint possibility with Margaret in that respect.
Okay. Okay, so again, tomorrow night, Shepherd of the Mountains Church on 224.
Correct.
What's the admission charge?
The admission is free. It's open to the community. That's why I'm in here, to get the word out to the community. There would be a free will offering taken. I'm covering the musicians. The free will offering will go to the International Rescue Committee.
Okay.
Aimed towards the Ukraine.
Okay. Keith Lilly, thanks for joining us to tell us about the 9th Christmas Concert in the Mountains.
I appreciate it very much, Roger. Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back after this. Well, let's go on out to Deer Valley and speak with Grace Dorfler and tell us what the scene's like over there, Grace.
Hey, good morning, Roger. It's looking snowy over here at Deer Valley. We've got skiers lining up, getting their boots on, getting their skis on, getting ready to head up the mountain in just a few minutes here. There's a lot planned today. I'm here with Emily Summers. She's the Director of Communications here at Deer Valley, and she is going to share a rundown of what's ahead for this evening. Emily, here you go.
Good morning, Emily.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining
me.
What's going on over there?
Well, and I bet they're putting the first skiers on the lift right behind us here, and the lifts are spinning. And here we go for season 45 at Deer Valley. And today is our exclusive Deer Valley Season Pass Holder Appreciation Day. And tomorrow is our official opening for all pass types.
Okay. Are there some special activities planned for the next couple of days?
Yes. Today, for our season pass holders, the restaurant's open, and you'll have a one-time use lunch voucher for today for Snow Park or Silver Lake. We've got our mountain operations and ski patrol up at Silver Lake between 10 and 2, and I'm guessing that means our very popular avalanche dogs. And you're all going to be surprised at how much Pacha has grown since he was introduced to the team in the spring. And then we've got a photo booth down in Snow Park Lodge in the 2002 room in front of our giant new trail map featuring all of the new runs and terrain to come this year. And, of course, live music at Snow Park and Silver Lake Lodges during the day today.
And and we'll also have that tomorrow as well?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. And give us a sense of how much terrain is open.
Yeah, so we're opening today with 3 lifts and 3 runs, so Carpenter Express at a snow park, and then the Success Ski Run off of that, and the Sterling Express chairlift and Bird's Eye Ski Run out of Silver Lake, and the Home Stake and Silver Lake runs that connect between Snow Park and Silver Lake. And we're starting there, and then we're encouraging everyone to keep an eye on our daily weather report at deervalley.com, and we'll be adding runs and lifts as available, and the forecast and the conditions out there are looking great for that.
Well, Emily, while I think everyone is excited for the opening of the resort at all, I think we're also excited about when we're going to get to see East Deer Valley. Any sense of how long it's going to take to get enough snow to get something open over there?
Yes, well, this year we have also doubled our snowmaking capacity, so that system is coming online right now over in the expansion, and we are targeting seeing some of the first runs there at the end of this month.
Anything else you want our listeners to know about things that are going on this weekend?
Yeah, the lifts are running on their regular schedule, so we're here to kick off the season, and we hope to see everyone up here. And also tomorrow kicks off Kids Ski Free Week. So we have from December 6th to 12th, kids 12 and under can get a free lift ticket every day.
And, you know, while we're chatting, let me go ahead and ask you about holiday plans. Are there special events coming up for the holidays?
Oh, yes. Our annual events are happening again. So Santa, he comes here before he hits his big night traveling the world. So he'll be here on Christmas Eve to visit with our skiers, and our annual torchlight parade on December 30th.
And Emily, with the opening of East Deer Valley, are there any new restaurant, on-mountain restaurant operations that are going to be associated with that?
Yeah, at the Deer Valley East Village Lodge, it's again another temporary structure, different from last year, and that's in place until our new lodge debuts in 1 to 2 years, and that has a new Deer Valley restaurant in it. And then in the next couple years, Park Peak Lodge at the top of Park Peak will come online with new offerings from the resort as well.
Are there any significant changes to the dining operation overall, other than the new facilities? Are you changing anything this year that we should know about?
No, it's pretty status quo. We did add, skiers will notice a new tent outside the Silver Lake Lodge, and that is overflow seating. It's a heated tent adjacent to our deck, and that's overflow seating that'll be open every day. And so just adjusting operations as we study skier flow and demand. So pretty normal food and beverage offerings, and our favorites are coming back, like Cast and Cut Seafood Dining and Fireside for evening operations.
Okay, Emily, thanks for spending time with us this morning. Is Grace dressed in ski gear? Is she going to get to go on the lift?
Yes. Only I can see her, so I think she's going to get on the chairlift.
Excellent. Thanks, Emily.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for this opening day broadcast. Coming up right after the news on Community Campfire, among the other stories, Amber's going to take us behind the scenes for a look at what it really takes to groom those mountains before sunrise, the unsung artistry that keeps Park City skiing smooth. You've been listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW Park City.